I think there are a lot of assumptions that we make and that form our worldview, but we don't necessarily think of them on a regular basis or reassess them to see if they're really true. One of those, I think, is that there is not much in common between humans and plants. But after listening to our guest today, you may all have to take a second look at that idea. Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Mueller. Daniel Shamovitz is the director of the Manna Center for Plant Biosciences at Tel Aviv University. He's the author of What a Plant Knows, a Field Guide to the Senses, and he joins us today from JCS News and Production Facilities in Tel Aviv, Israel. Danny, thanks so much for spending time with us today.
Well, thanks for interviewing me, Judith.
So this is a really fascinating book, and the reason I'm pretty confident that people are going to have to take a second look at a lot of things that they believe is that I had that experience on pretty much every page of your book and thinking, wow, I had no idea, or wow, I just never thought of it that way. And so I think that, you know, most people would never ascribe the idea of having senses as we think of them to plants. But you make a strong and really convincing case for it. What do we need to keep in mind when we attribute a sense to a plant?
We need to keep in mind that plants don't sense the world like we do. They don't have feelings. They're not subjective. But the fact that they're not subjective doesn't mean that they're not completely aware of their environment. Plants are a lot more than just passive objects in our environment that are visually pleasing for us. They're constantly monitoring their environment. They know what they're seeing. They know what light waves are hitting them. They know what they're smelling. They find chemicals in the air and respond to them. They know what they're feeling. They know when they're being touched or when they're being shook in the wind. And they actually even remember what happened maybe last week. So they're much more active and much, much more complex than we actually stop to give them credit for.
And I think one of the really interesting points you make that is probably one of the most obvious, but it's one of those things that you don't think about until someone really kind of puts it right in your face. You make the point that plants really need sharp and accurate senses because, unlike the rest of us, they can't get up and move out of danger or to a better location. So they can't look across the lawn and think, wow, you know, I think there's a little more sunlight over there. I think I'm going to pack up and move over there. They're stuck where they're planted.
Yeah, exactly. It's actually the plant's seeming passivity which dictates its genetic complexity. From a genetic point of view, it's actually somewhat disconcerting to know that plants have more genes than people do. Just last month, the tomato genome was finally published, and tomatoes have about 8,000 more genes than humans. And one of the reasons that plants have more genes is that they're sessile. They're rooted, literally rooted to the ground. They can't move. They can't escape. So, you know, I've been to Madison several times, and Madison in December, you know, it can be harsh for someone who's coming from Israel. So you could escape and, you know, go south if you're cold, or you could turn up the heat in your house, or in the summer.
Or you could grab an extra jacket and put it on.
Yeah. But in the summer, when you get those huge heat waves, or when you're having the drought that you have now, you could just drink more. A plant has to stand there and just absorb it all. You know, it has to survive temperatures from below zero up to above 100 without being able to move, without being able to run away. It has to be able to, you know, find its mates by standing, you know, in one place. Mm-hmm. And the way it does that is by constantly monitoring its environment and by adapting adapting physiologically. You know, we often deal with stress by running from it. A plant has to deal with stress by changing its biology.
Hmm. Yeah, their fight or flight really doesn't work too well.
Yeah, it's sort of like adapt or die.
Right, right. So in the chapter, What a Plant Sees, and you go through different senses throughout the book and really explain what the biology is and the science behind plants having that ability, but then also how that manifests itself in their life cycle. In the chapter, What a Plant Sees, you start off by saying, plants monitor their visible environment all the time. Plants see if you come near them. They know when you stand over them. They even know if you're wearing a blue or red shirt. They know if you've painted your house or if you've moved their pots from one side of the living room to the other. I certainly didn't realize that they were capable of that kind of awareness. How do they do it?
Okay, first, when I use the word know, I mean, we have to put air quotes around them, because plants don't know in the same way that we know, and they don't see in the same way that we see. Plants aren't aware of whether I have curly hair or if I'm balding, but that's not relevant for them. But they definitely know if you have a red shirt or a blue shirt, because what happens is if you're having on a blue shirt, blue light is actually bouncing off of you. And that blue light is being hit by the plant. And that's affecting how it grows. Now, you probably see this in the plants that you have growing in your windows at home. You know how they bend towards the light?
Mm-hmm.
You know, they bend. You know, of course, you understand at one level that they're bending in order to get to the light because they need to eat it. You know, plants eat light. They take light and turn that solar energy into sugars and oxygen, sugars for us to eat and oxygen for us to breathe. But so plants have to know where their food is. So plants are aware of not only the intensity of the light, but its direction. And what's really interesting, and as you said, you know, most people don't know this, is that plants not only see light, they differentiate between red and blue. And this was actually an experiment that Darwin did over 100 years ago. Mm. If you put a small seedling in a completely dark room and then just light a candle on one side of the room, a very, very dim candle, it will bend towards that candle. And then if you would put like red cellophane over it and put another candle on the other side of the room with blue cellophane over it, it will always bend towards the blue one.
Hmm.
So it's not only that plants see light, just like us, they differentiate between colors. And if we're talking about complexity, while we can see red, blue, and green, plants can see red and blue, but they also see things that we're completely blind to.
Hmm.
They see UV light. They see far red light. You know, from a plant's point of view, we're actually visually challenged.
They feel sorry for us.
Well, I don't know if they feel sorry.
Well, we are talking with Daniel Shamovitz. He is the director of the Manna Center for Plant Biosciences at Tel Aviv University. He's the author of a fascinating new book, What a Plant Knows, A Field Guide to the Senses. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Have you ever thought about plants as having senses? Have you or your children ever done experiments to test that or just accidentally created conditions that produced interesting results? Danny would love to hear from you and help explain what you've observed. You can call us or you can also send an email to talk@WPR.org. And as always, you can leave a question or comment on our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mehler Show, and Mehler is spelled M-E-I-L-L-E-R. And, you know, I think we all know, like you said, the plants need light, but they use light in some pretty sophisticated ways, and they measure the amount of light as a way to regulate, for instance, when they're seeding or when they're blooming. What are some of the interesting applications for that?
Well, before we get into what are the applications, I just want to make one more point about why I call it sight. You know, a lot of people, when they first hear that, they say, well, it's not the same thing as people seeing, because we know we see in pictures. But if you think about it at a really serious level, if you take someone who's completely blind and allow that blind person now to differentiate between light and dark, or allow them to see colors, for that person, even though they're not seeing pictures, that would be remedial vision. So even for humans, not all vision has to be seeing pictures. And so, of course, plants don't see pictures, but just like a blind person who has gotten some type of sight back, they can see light. And not only do they absorb the light like we do, they respond to it in different parts. You know, like when you're playing baseball and you see the ball coming at you, your eyes see it, and then your hand responds. It goes out and you catch the ball, or in my case, miss the ball. So the same thing for a plant, like when it's bending towards the light, it's the tip of the plant that's seeing, that's absorbing the light, but the bending is going down the stem. So the plant is actually transferring the signal from the tip of the plant down to the bottom, just like our eyes transfer a signal to the brain and then to our hand. So getting back to your question about, you know, what's the applications? Well, one of the most obvious applications we see in flower growing in hothouses. I'm sure most of the listeners know that different plants flower at different times during the year. And the way a plant knows when to flower often is by how long the day is. And the way it knows how long the day is by it sees different colors of light. Now, if you would go outside in the morning, you know, you could see the sun coming up and the light gets progressively brighter. The spectrum is getting more and more towards the red. That signals to the plant that the day has started. When the sun goes down and you're seeing a beautiful sunset, right at the end, we're seeing a lot of far red light that we basically don't see. We're sort of blind to. The plant, when it gets far red light, that signals it that the day is done. And it can measure how long it is until the lights go back on again. And so the flower growers can then manipulate this. So if they want it to think that, for example, that the night is really, really short, it can then just turn on the lights just a little bit in the middle of the day, in the middle of the night, with just the red without coming out with a far red afterward. And they'll think that the day has started already. So that way a flower grower can manipulate how long it's been since the plants have seen the light and determine when it's going to flower. That's how we get all the flowers ready, by the way, for Mother's Day.
Exactly.
Just by turning on the red light.
And one interesting application of that, I think, is for Christian listeners, Easter lilies are very common, but Easter moves by several weeks every year. And so when you think about it, the flower growers have to be able to manipulate those lilies to be ready to bloom on a particular date that is very different than the date the year before or the year after.
Yeah, and we can do that, or the growers can do that, by manipulating the light environment. That's something that's been known for almost a century, and it's been, people didn't really think of it as seeing, but now we understand what's the biology, what are the photoreceptors behind it, and how this is actually being translated into either inhibiting the flowering or allowing it to happen.
And it was interesting in the book, Danny, that you say that it only takes a couple seconds of that light, that it's not that you have to have it on, but even just flicking it on for a couple seconds and then turning it back off just kind of resets that for the plants
respond. The mechanism here is actually incredibly cool, because what happens is it's the same protein, the same photoreceptor, that's seeing both red and far red light. Just like in the back of our retina, we have proteins that we know of that are photoreceptors that see red or blue or green light. A plant has a protein that when it sees red light, it gets turned on. This is a protein called phytochrome, and actually one of the main people who's been studying this protein is actually at the University of Wisconsin, Professor Rick Veistra. And the same protein, when it gets turned on by the red light, it tells the plant it's day. And then at the end of the day, when it sees the far red light, that actually turns the protein off. It switches it off. Then when it sees red light in the morning, it turns it back on. It sees the far red again, it turns it back off. So it really is a molecular switch that's turned on and off by the light. And so it only needs 5 seconds to either turn it on or to turn it off.
And we are talking with Daniel Shamovitz. He is director of the Manna Center for Plant Biosciences at Tel Aviv University, author of What a Plant Knows, A Field Guide to the Senses. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Mueller. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And I want to make sure people know, Danny, that your last name is spelled Chamovitz, so they can easily find the book.
Oh,
and
thanks.
We have, sure, with a name like Sears-Poisson, I understand the importance of spelling. We have Joyce in Oconomowoc on the line, so let's go there. Hi, Joyce.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I've heard you mention the senses. I've not heard you say anything about sound, so my question is this. Are plants sensitive to sound, for example, voice or music?
That's a great question, and Danny, you cover that in a fun way and in a very interesting way in the book, too.
Yeah, I was waiting for that question. You know, it's, of all the senses, I've known people that are shocked to hear that plants can see or that they can smell, but somehow everyone thinks that plants can hear. It's sort of inversely proportional to the amount of evidence. And Joyce, I'm sorry to say, until now, there's really no evidence that plants can hear. And there's definitely no evidence that plants respond to the sounds that we like. Now, you might have heard some type of studies that show that plants like classical music, or that plants like Indian classical music, or that I've even seen studies that show that plants like Meatloaf's Bat Out of Hell. The problem with these studies have all been that the plants grew better in the music that the person who was doing the experiment liked themselves. Which doesn't mean that they were out to fool us. I think it usually means that we treat our plants better when we're happier, and we're happy around music that we like.
Mm-hmm.
So if it makes you happier to talk to your plants, and that makes you treat them better, then keep talking to them. But just know that they're probably not hearing you.
I have a friend who has two tomato plants, and he talks to one and doesn't talk to the other. And the one that he talks to is doing better, but he also caresses that plant.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, he probably gives it a little bit more water on the side also.
Gets that little extra teaspoon of Miracle-Gro or whatever.
Exactly. Now, that being said, I'm not going to say that plants necessarily don't hear something that would be ecologically relevant for them. You know, our voices and our music are completely ecologically irrelevant for a plant. You know, when I talk about plant vision, I don't show them an eye chart and say, big E, little A, read me the bottom line.
Mm-hmm.
The same thing for music. You know, rock music or soft music has no relevance whatsoever for a plant. if a plant hears, it's probably listening to like the buzzing of a insect's wings or something like that.
Like a pollinator approaching or something like that.
Yeah, but that research hasn't been done yet. Or if it's been done, the results have been negative. So that means that they're deaf.
Thanks for that call, Joyce. And I have to say, Danny, one of the things that made me laugh out loud reading your book was that you said those experiments tell us more about the musical tastes of plant biologists than it does about plant hearing.
Exactly.
But you do talk about a really interesting, I'm glad Joyce brought up hearing, because you talked about how the, you know, genes that are shared between plants and humans, and plants having so many more genes. One of the genes that's actually shared is a gene that's related to deafness.
Right. Yeah, plants have a deaf gene, just like humans have deaf genes. Now, the misnomer here is that you could say, oh, since plants have deaf genes, they're deaf. Now, the reason that we call a gene by its disease is because people become deaf when there's a mutation in that gene. Just like there's the gene for breast cancer that unfortunately some people have.
Mm-hmm.
And we know about that because they have a mutation in the gene which leads to the propensity for breast cancer. But it also ends up that all plants also have the gene for breast cancer. But they don't have breasts.
Hmm.
So, you know, because these genes don't exist to give us disease. They exist because we need our cells need them for various functions. When they go awry, when there's a mutation in them, we get the disease. So plants also have the deaf gene, for example. In humans, the deaf gene is necessary. One of these deaf genes is necessary for the filaments in our inner ear, the hairs in our inner ear to grow. And when it doesn't grow properly, then we don't hear. In plants, when they don't have one of these genes, they don't make the filaments on their roots. The filaments on the roots aren't there to hear. They're there to absorb water. So from a biological point of view, you need this gene to make filaments. We use those filaments to hear. Plants use those filaments to drink.
Hmm. So it's there for different purposes.
It's there for different purposes at the organismal level, at the cellular level, and that's the cool part of the biology here. Animals and plants share a huge number of genes because a plant cell and an animal cell about 1.5 billion years ago had the same ancestor. So any gene that is necessary for a cell to function will be found in both animals, among them humans, of course, and plants. So that's why plants have the gene, for example, for breast cancer and cystic fibrosis. And humans have the gene for what's called photomorphogenesis, which was a plant gene that tells them when to open their leaves.
Huh.
We lost our leaves somewhere along the line, but we still have those genes.
Wow. Well, this and many other fascinating facts are in Daniel Shamovitz's book, What a Plant Knows, A Field Guide to the Senses. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I hope you'll stay tuned, because at 11:45, we're going to continue talking about observing the natural world and seeing a lot more similarities with people than we might expect. We're going to talk with the authors of Gifts of the Crow, How Perception, Emotion, and Thought Allow Smart Birds to Behave Like Humans. And right now we are talking about plants and the senses that they have and how they're a little more similar to humans, or we are to them, than we might think. Dan, let's go to Sue in De Pere next. Hi, Sue.
How are you today?
Good.
Good. Well, although I'm much older now, while I was in high school, I did a science project, and it was on the effects of talking to and music played for tomato plants. And I had two different control groups, both in the rooms with southern exposure. I measured out and gave them both the exact same amount of water. And it did turn out the room that I had music playing 16 hours a day versus the room that never had any music and no stimulation, the plants in the room that had the music grew way better than the other plants did. So I find it kind of interesting, the information you're talking about today.
And Danny, what would you say to that?
Well, I want to ask Sue one question. First of all, any experiment that anyone does at any time in their life is important, especially if you're doing it with the proper controls. And I can't argue with the results because I didn't see how it being done. And it could be when she did it, that really were the results. When you did your control, was there speakers in the room that were turned on with no music?
No, the room that didn't have any music happened to be my parents' bedroom, and they didn't
okay,
have a TV, radio.
So a friend of mine did... A friend of mine who's a professor in England did a similar experiment. He was the one who showed that the meatloaf's bat out of hell made corn grow better. But when he repeated the experiment and just had the speakers on with no music coming out, he got the same result, which he ended up that it was some type of heat coming out of the speaker that changed a little bit of the environment, and that was causing it to happen. So it really wasn't the music, it was the presence of the speaker.
Okay. Sounds good.
So I'm not saying if that's what happened in your experiment, of course, because we don't have the control, but it's one possible explanation.
Thanks, Sue. And Chuck in Green Bay emails, do plants communicate with each other? And actually, I wanted to move on to the What a Plant Smells chapter.
That's a great question.
Yeah, and you had some really interesting information about that.
Yeah, so plants definitely exchange information with each other. I want to get to the question of communication, because communication also implies that there was, intent. There's definitely an exchange of information. For example, we know that for the past 30 years that if one tree is infested with caterpillars, for example, it gives off a cloud of gas that the tree next to it then picks up. And when it absorbs this gas, it starts making chemicals that then make it resistant to the caterpillars. When this was first reported around 1980, the press loved this. They were saying, that the plants are screaming and they're warning their neighbors, which is our interpretation. That's our anthropomorphizing of it. So at the scientific level, yes, when one tree is eaten, it sends off a signal that its neighbors pick up and then protect themselves. But now what we're trying to understand is this really calling out, saying, watch out, protect yourself? Or is it maybe that one branch on the same tree is communicating with its other branches? And the fastest way for them to communicate with each other will be by a volatile signal, by a gas. And the tree next to it is just eavesdropping or eavesmelling. So
just happens to hear the message.
It's just smelling, So, these are evolutionary questions which actually fit in with your previous guest talking about, altruism and how do you succeed. So on the one hand, there is actually a model that shows that if one plant is helping the other one, it's helping the whole forest succeed. So there could be a model made to that. So we don't know what the intent was, but they're definitely communicating. That being said, we also have to remember that a lot of times, like if we take aspen trees, what look to us like individual trees are all one organism. They're sort of like grass. They have individual trunks, but they have a common root system.
Oh, okay.
So when one tree is helping another tree, they're actually helping themselves.
And when you talk about those volatile compounds that they're releasing, are those specific if it's a caterpillar versus we're having an issue with flea beetles this year versus Japanese beetles versus some kind of a fungus? Are they giving really specific information, or is it I'm under attack and my system is stressed?
And just do anything. Well, that's an excellent question. That's actually one of the main questions in plant biology today is what is the specificity? We know that at least it's specific for insects versus microorganisms, that if a plant is attacked by an insect versus whether it's attacked by a fungus or a bacteria, it will give off different signals. Whether different types of beetles give off or different types of insects cause a plant to give off different signals or different plants can give off different signals, that's a matter of research still going on.
Because it seems like the information would be of more limited use if it's just a general kind of distress call than if it's happening to me and this is what
you could get rid of all many insects in the same way. So that general call is pretty good, just like a plant can protect itself against bacteria, different bacteria, all in the same way. And so that's why so far we only know of two signals. But two different volatile chemicals, but that doesn't mean that there aren't more that we haven't found yet.
I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Mueller, talking with Daniel Shamovitz, who's the director of the Manna Center for Plant Biosciences at Tel Aviv University and author of What a Plant Knows, A Field Guide to the Senses. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Have you noticed a behavior in plants that you'd like Danny to help explain? I'm sure he'd be happy to do that. And you can also email a question or comment to talk@wpr.org. And Lucas in Waukun, Iowa is next. Hi, Lucas.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Sure.
My question is, how long-term do the senses of these plants, get passed on to the next generation as far as long-term climate changes? Are they able to tell their offspring, this is the trend we're seeing and you need to watch out for it?
That's a great question. And so that brings into play the sense of memory, which you talk about, Danny.
Oh, it's such a great question, actually, that I'm in the middle of writing a huge grant proposal to answer it.
Oh, there you go. Stay tuned, Lucas.
This is actually one of the key issues, I think, right now in all of biology, is what's called biological plasticity and how we pass this information on. We now know that not only in plants, but also in animals, that when we're affected in a different environment, we can actually pass this information on to our offspring, and they respond accordingly. And it's been known now for a few years that plants that are going through a drought, for example, like you're going right now, mm-hmm. I understand, in Wisconsin, there's a chance that their offspring, the offspring of the plants that survived, will themselves be more primed to be resistant to drought. How many generations that can go is a matter of debate right now. I've seen studies that say 3, 4, 5 generations, and I've seen studies that say after one generation that memory is wiped out and isn't passed on. The difference could be it depends how the studies had been done. What was the stress? How exactly they were doing it? We still don't really understand the basic mechanisms about how this was done more than it's what's called epigenetics. There are a lot of groups studying this right now. There was a very good study from the University of Nebraska just a few months ago that showed this type of memory to drought.
And so you're saying that the plant, like say a plant that's planted right now and is dealing with the drought, it can pass information along to the next generation. But that's obviously they're passing along adaption that they've had to make themselves.
All right, so we need to, I want to define a few things that I'm talking about. First of all, I'm talking about memory. You know, I'm not talking about memory of, oh my God, did I have a bad week? You know, I'm talking about a memory is that you have some type of information, you encode that information, and then you retrieve that information sometime in the future. Okay, so we're not talking about an emotional memory. But it's just sort of like our own immune systems. You know, when you got the chicken pox as a kid, you never got it again because your body remembers that the next time it sees this virus, this bacteria, it knows how to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the type of memories we're dealing with here. What we're talking about in this type of adaptation, transgenerational adaptation, it's not your classic Darwinian evolution where there's a mutation in a gene and then that's passed on. What we're talking here is a change in the entire genome. All the genes at once are somehow being modified to change what's going on and off to make the offspring more adaptable. It's really a paradigm shift in biology. It's a mechanism that's called epigenetics. It's above your normal genetic code. And scientists all over the world are trying to understand how this is regulated and how it's passed on.
And thanks for that call, Lucas. And I want to go back briefly, Danny, to the idea of smell and how we use plants' ability to smell to our own benefit when we want to ripen a piece of fruit. Can you explain the science behind how one fruit ripens another?
You know, this idea of smell, you know, people, you know, of course plants smell, they give off a smell, but, you know, smelling is absorbing a volatile chemical in the air and reacting. You know, on the 4th of July when your neighbor turned up its barbecue and those smells of the grilling meat came across the lawn, you didn't think about how you're going to respond. You just started salivating. You didn't have a choice because those chemicals, you know. So again, we're not talking about anything with choice here. So if you have a very hard avocado or a very unripe peach, for example, what's the best way to get it to ripen quickly? You put it in a paper bag together with something that's really ripe, like a really ripe banana. You know, a lot of people do that at home. And the reason that that works is because the ripe fruit gives off a chemical called ethylene, which is actually a ripening chemical. It's a ripening hormone. It's the hormone that causes fruits to ripen. And so the unripe avocado then picks up the ethylene from the ripe banana, and this ethylene tells the unripe avocado, you better start ripening quickly. So it's actually the unripe fruit is smelling, again in air quotes, the ripe one.
And it doesn't matter that it's two different kinds of fruit.
It's the same chemical. It's the same chemical.
Great. I found that really, really interesting. And also, we had a caller that was wondering about some more examples of the experiments that have been done to measure the senses. And one that I found really interesting because I've always thought they were really interesting plants is how the mechanism works on a Venus flytrap to close around its prey.
So the Venus flytrap is one of the few plants that we can somewhat identify with because we can see it moving. You know, most plants, they seem completely, you know, inanimate to us, but the Venus flytrap is, you know, completely kinetic. So if you've ever seen one, and if you haven't seen it happen, go onto YouTube or go to my website. There's some very good videos of the flytrap closing. And you can see the fly going across the flytrap's leaves, and the trap will only close when the fly gets to the middle, which leads to the question, how does it know that the fly is in the middle? And actually, it won't close on any fly, only on a big one. It doesn't want to waste its energy on a small meal. And the way it knows that is that in the middle of the leaves, there are about three or four big hairs coming out of the leaves. When the fly touches one hair, nothing happens. But when it touches the second one, and if it does it within about 20 seconds, then the trap immediately closes. And what happens, and this is maybe scary that it's so similar to what happens to us, is that there's an electrical signal. Just like when a fly lands on your arm, it causes an electrical signal which goes to your brain, and then your hand tries to hit it, and then you might miss it. When the fly touches those two hairs on the fly trap, there's an electrical signal which goes throughout the leaves, and then it slaps closed. So you're seeing two things here. One, an electrical signal, which is very nerve-like mm-hmm. in function. And second, memory. It's first remembering that the first hair was touched, and then only after the second one is touched, that means it's a big bug, it'll close. But it's a short-term memory. If the second hair is touched after about 20 seconds, it forgets that the first one was touched already, so it won't close.
Does it also have a mechanism for not wasting its energy trying to grab something too big? I mean, it doesn't want to expend its energy to grab something that's not small enough to be worth a meal. But what about something much bigger?
Oh, that's actually an interesting question. I hadn't thought about that. but I guess it probably does because they don't. I guess if too many of the hairs are touched too quickly, and I don't know if this is true, I'm just hypothesizing right now, it wouldn't close because they don't close in the rain when they're being touched mm-hmm. all the time. They sort of like get sensitized mm-hmm. and then know not to close.
Or like so if you put your finger in it, it wouldn't try to eat your finger.
Oh, no, it definitely will because you're just touching one or two and then it'll close right on it.
Mm. All right. Well, there's another subject for Grant.
Then you'll kill your Venus flytraps because it won't have anything to eat. It'll close, use all its energy, and then die.
Oh, well, we won't do that experiment then. Hannah in Appleton has a touch-related question. Hi, Hannah.
Hi. Yes, I was wondering about... Thanks for having me.
Sure.
So I was wondering about the sensitive plant when you touch its leaves.
Mimosa. Yeah.
Yes, and then if you touch the stem, the whole thing collapses down and then it slowly comes back. I always think, oh, it's coming back when it feels comfortable or trust you.
Yeah.
You know, when you think of it like it's human in a way. But how is that? Does that work basically the same way? Or
it's basically the same mechanism. The mimosa plant, the sensitive plant, it closes when you touch it. You shouldn't anthropomorphize it. It's not that it's sad when it's doing this, even
or
though
shy.
It looks like it's drooping or shy. Actually, in some places, it's called the drooping plant or the shy plant. In Hebrew, it's called just don't touch me. But it's an electric signal that goes up and down the stem, which causes it to close. And actually, ecologically, the reason it's doing that is because it's normally found in rainforests. And it closes up so that the rain can just run off it. And so it doesn't get run over or it doesn't get knocked over by these torrential rains.
Wow, interesting. Thank you.
Sure.
Sure.
Thanks for that call, Hannah. And Tad in Ontario, Wisconsin, also has a question. Hi, Tad.
Good morning. I don't know how to phrase this because, like you said, plants with no, with air quotes, but do plants gain knowledge? Is an older plant smarter, air quotes, than a younger plant?
Oh, that's a great question. Thanks, Ed.
I guess you could say that for certain things. For example, a plant that's been through stress and survived, it itself will then be more hardy against the future stress. So it has learned to adapt to it. A plant, they have like an immune memory just like we do. If it has seen a certain type of bacteria, it then becomes hardier against that bacteria in the future. So plants, I mean, I'm really, I don't want to get too much into psychology here. My wife did her PhD in multiple intelligences and said, don't even touch that. But, you know, there is a type of remedial learning going on here. But I don't think that's unique to plants. All of life needs to know how to learn and to adapt in order to survive. If any life form can't adapt, In other words, if it can't learn from its environment, it'll be selected against, it'll die. So, you know, of course, this skill has, you know, gone to new heights in humans, but it's not unique to humans. All organisms need to be able to sense their environment, learn from it, and adapt.
And so, Danny, we just have a couple minutes left, but you end the book with a chapter called The Aware Plant. What does that awareness that you and many other scientists have been able to study and examine and draw meaning from, what does that mean for the science of studying plants, and what does it mean for the rest of us in everyday life?
Well, for the science of plants, it's very important for us to know that these plants are living, you know, dynamic organisms that if we don't understand how a plant feels its environment, how a plant senses its environment, how it's aware to it, and how it adapts, our own future as a species is in trouble. I mean, you know, if by the year 2050 there'll be 9 billion people in the world, which is 3 times more than the year I was born, and that world's going to be hotter, with less water, with less fertilizers, we're going to be in a big trouble in feeding that world. I mean, our entire existence is dependent on plants. You know, I'm sitting on a plant right now. I'm writing on plants. We breathe oxygen made by plants. We all eat plants. We drink plants. We run cars that are running on old plants. We have to understand how a plant senses its environment and adapts, not only for the basic science, but so that we can assure our own survival. In Southeast Asia now, they're less worried about Alzheimer than they are about feeding themselves. Mm. We don't want to find ourselves in that place in another 20 or 30 years because we're not being able to understand and help our plants grow in harsher environments. So that's why research in plant sciences and how plants understand their environment, I think, is the utmost importance. It should be our number one priority for the next decade, because we're going to find ourselves in a major, major problem if we don't. On another level, I think for us to understand, you know, if a plant sees, if a plant smells, if a plant feels, and if a plant can remember, what does that mean about us? Does that mean that we're not unique as humans? Does that mean that, you know, that there's nothing? You know, I know some people got very depressed or very defensive when I came up with this.
Because they didn't feel as special as they used to?
Yeah, you know. I actually think it's the exact opposite. I think, you know, we could think, well, what makes us human? And I think what differentiates us between humans and plants isn't the fact that we have senses or that we're aware. It's the fact that we're talking about it. Mm-hmm. It's the fact that we care, that we're analyzing it. Plants are not subjective. They don't care. You know, there's no pain involved there. There's no subjectivity. You know, and this helps us understand ourselves as humans and what's our place in the world.
Well, it's been a fascinating conversation, and it's really an intriguing book. Daniel Shamovitz, director of the Manna Center for Plant Biosciences at Tel Aviv University and the author of What a Plant Knows, A Field Guide to the Senses. Danny, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me. It was a great pleasure.
And if you're interested in finding Danny's book, there is a link from our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mehler Show, M-E-I-L-L-E-R, to Daniel Shamovitz's website. And his last name is spelled C-H-A-M-O-V-I-T-Z, in case you're looking for it. Well, coming up next, we're going to have another conversation about other creatures that we may not think are as similar to human beings as they are, and all the different interesting ways that we interact with them. We're going to talk with the authors of Gifts of the Crow, How Perception, Emotion, and Thought Allow Smart Birds to Behave Like Humans. It really is an eye-opening book, and I hope you'll stay tuned. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Mehler.